Welcome, everyone. This is More Podcast, Less Process. I am Jefferson Bailey.
Hello, Jefferson.
Hello, Josh. Who are you?
I'm Josh.
Excellent. Good to hear. So this week's guest, I will let her introduce herself.
Is that because you don't know how to pronounce my name?
No, it's Kate Timer. Timer?
Timer.
Themer?
No, it's
Ooh,
Timer.
Themer would be good.
I've heard that one. That's been tried out on me.
That's
but,
pretty good.
I've gotten Ranger.
Ranger.
Yeah, a lot.
Okay.
Surprising amount.
Yeah.
And I'm surprised because it's a noun. How do you mess up a noun?
You can mess anything up.
So our topic today is basically whatever Kate wants to talk about. But I think we do have some topics. So you've obviously been blogging a good bit or tweeting about your upcoming book series. So we were hoping that we could maybe draw from some of the topics that those edited volumes will be about and maybe talk about some of the interesting use cases or projects that tied into those themes or how you saw the themes or topics developing across archives.
Sure. I'm happy to talk about this series forthcoming from Scarecrow in spring 2014 to a book catalog near you. They approached me. I had worked with the editor before, and he approached me about doing a series of. They're doing a series of best practices. That's what the series is in libraries. And when I thought about doing it, I shied away from calling it a series of best practice case studies because I thought that could be a little dodgy because archivists, you know, like to argue about what the best practices might be. So I thought it would be more interesting to look at innovative case studies. And although I've gotten nervous about the claim that these are innovative because, and we can talk about what is or isn't innovative because that's could be a contentious issue, but I thought that would be more useful. And I also framed these books more broadly. They don't exactly conform to the essay's fundamental series, but they're in broad areas of practice. The first four are gonna be management, description, outreach, and reference and access. So they're pretty broad topics, and it was interesting to think for me in reviewing the, because I did a call for proposals and I solicited some, what it would mean exactly to be innovative in something like management.
We all know there's no innovation in management.
Exactly. What is that going to mean? So because I'm going to have to write, you know, an introduction that defends why these are innovative and talks about what I mean by that. So it's been interesting. And I was thinking in thinking about it, one goal that I have for the books is to be valuable to a broad range of practitioners. I like everything that I do to be useful. And so while some people are definitely going to say, look at some of the case studies, and they're going to roll their eyes and say, this isn't innovative, blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, some people think MPLP isn't innovative because some archives have been doing this for a long time, which is true. But, you know, what's not innovative to you may be innovative to somebody else. And certainly, if I only had case studies that were on the bleeding edge of archival practice, they'd be very interesting, but I want things that people can actually use.
It would be a short volume, too.
Yeah, and it would involve lots of QR codes.
And Mark Matienzo would have written everything. So, you know, there we go. So that's sort of the concept of the books, to make them, you know, yes, innovative, but draw from a lot of different areas and have ideas that people can use even if the particular thing that somebody's talking about isn't something they can implement right away.
So was it difficult to find use cases that sort of tied into those themes that mirror the fundamental series?
Not.
It seems like some would have more innovative practices in this area and fewer in another area.
Sure. When I put out the call for outreach, what I got was a lot. I got a lot of good stuff, but I got a lot of people doing things with instruction. And so I've decided to split that off into its own topic. So K through 12, undergraduate, working with graduate students, et cetera, because that's big. There's enough there for a whole book, which will be, I'm going to be doing two more, and that's one of the two others that I'm going to be doing. So yeah, there was a lot in outreach, which is not that surprising, I think, because a lot of people are interested in doing something new. Description was challenging. There were a lot of good responses, but when I looked at it, I was trying to I wanted to make sure that we had, like, EAC. I needed to, you know, I needed to find somebody for EAC.
Right, checkbox for EAC.
Got to have EAC, must have. And crowdsourcing description. So I was sort of looking through it, and with that one and with reference also, I tried to, in my own mind, break down what it means, for example, reference. You know, what are the stages of reference? What are the parts of that process to make sure that I had coverage in the different areas of it? So for description also, you know, who is doing the describing? What are we describing? How are you delivering the description? Sort of looking at the different elements to at least try to, as much as I could, make sure that I had something in each of those areas. So there was some method to it.
And what was the most challenging?
I think it might have been, you mean, it's sort of, description was the most challenging, and within that one, I wanted to get a variety of who is doing the describing. So, and I went after a couple projects and was unsuccessful. Another thing that I learned in this process is that sometimes the people who are doing really innovative things either don't have the time to write about them or don't feel that they're far enough along that they want to talk about it.
Right.
And I tried to convince them otherwise, but I was not always successful.
Yeah, I guess defining innovation does sort of imply a certain, completion, or at least so that you be far enough along in your innovative practice that you can have some ability to reflect upon it.
Yeah, and in some cases, people are in the middle of a project, and I still think that the approach is worth discussing, and I think there's enough there for people to look at. Really, it's for people to get ideas, and it's like a lot of things. Some ideas are going to work, and some aren't for people in different settings. Mm-hmm. So,
well, that's we were talking earlier about failing.
Yeah, we're always talking.
Yeah. Sorry, we were talking about me, I have to admit. And so that brings up an interesting point of that feeling that people feel like they have to be far enough along in something, or it has to be done, or to have something to show, because potentially a fear of failure. Mm-hmm. Were there any use cases where it was a failed use case?
Yes and no. There was one. I won't name it, where the person submitted this and I gave her comments back, and I kept saying, I feel like there's something you're not talking, feel like you're talking around something here. I want more here. And so then she set up a time to talk on the phone, and what it turned out was that things just hadn't quite worked out the way they were supposed to. And I said, that's fantastic. Can you talk about that? Because people always love to hear when things don't work out. And the project ultimately succeeded. But they had to readjust. They had to adjust. And it's much better when you're actually talking about what really happened than trying to write around something that you can't talk about. And that's there's one use case about a university that was updating their security procedures. And similarly, there was a point at which I kept saying, well, what about, just like, I feel like something's not here. And then later, when they were sending in their second draft, they said, well, what happened was we had a theft and we weren't allowed to talk about it yet, but we've now gotten the permission to talk about it. So
something
now
something literally wasn't there.
And so they have gotten permission to talk about it. And so now it really makes a lot more sense why they were reviewing their security procedures. So, and actually there's another case study in the management book about dealing with an internal theft. A university had a student worker who stole some things. And that's really interesting to read about how how they dealt with the sort of the aftermath of that. So yeah, to take that example about dealing with an insider theft, it's not like that's innovative per se, because people have been stealing things for a really long time. But I think that that's the kind of issue that we, as a profession, we hear about more often. And I don't know if it's happening more often, but it certainly seems like we're hearing about it more than we used to.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, and it's something that's kind of covered in the management books, but very rarely do they actually talk about what really happened.
Yeah, I mean, I think you see that sometimes in the sort of digital preservation world of data loss is not actually, I mean, it does happen and it is not much discussed in a similar way as theft, right? I mean, something catastrophic that might be managerial error if it's not technological error, yet provides a lot of benefit to people if it is discussed because, you know, lesson learned and whatnot.
Yeah. I've been kind of shying away from doing a book on digital preservation. I know if I continue doing the series, I know I'm going to have to do it. But it intimidates me, so I'm putting it off until later.
So how many books are there total?
There are going to be four coming out in spring 2014. That's right. Spring 2014
and
from
you're
Scarecrow Press.
Signed on for more after that.
I'm going to do two more. Doing four at a time was too much.
That does sound like a lot.
It's a lot. And that's why the blog has been slow and why I haven't been on Twitter as much, because I really need to knuckle down and get this done. The next two are going to be on appraisal and acquisition, which I think is going to be really fun, and the one on instruction. So I'm really looking forward to seeing what's out there on appraisal and acquisition. Because I think that's one of those areas where there's, when you're in school, you know, you read all the theory about appraisal, but I'd like to, you know, I think there's a market for real world stories about how it works.
Right.
Again, that's going to be interesting to see what people are willing to talk about, because I've had people say they have interesting stories and they may or may not be, you know, able to talk about them. So
yeah, there's a lot of budgetary and monetary implications too to some of those acquisition issues.
Yes, actually, there's a case study in the management book from the Library and Archives Canada, which is actually about an acquisition issue of them telling a policy that they had that were saying that if they were going to acquire the papers of nonprofits and corporations and things like that, they were going to try to get those organizations to contribute resources towards the selection and processing, basically. So they weren't just going to take them unless the organization helped.
Right.
So that seemed like a good one for the management book, because there were definitely issues.
Yeah, sounds complicated. Sounds like something that probably is not going to be too successful either. Was it successful,
actually,
or how did it
turn
out?
It was pretty successful.
Yeah.
You know, there were things that got away, but there were other things where when they actually talked to the organization and explained, they understood, and they said, okay, we'll help shoulder this burden. And there are benefits from having, in some cases, they had internal people do the processing, and there are people who know the organization, so there was a benefit to that, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've actually been seeing that quite a bit lately in the projects that I work on. Just within organizations that they're starting to do that, of not exactly leaning on donors, but but people who donate stuff and kind of saying, like, you know, if you want this process sooner, or if, you know,
it's sort of a
well, I, you know, I guess it's maybe a difference too with audiovisual materials, is just the fact that they have to be reformatted before they're even accessible often. So even if they acquire something and process it, it doesn't mean people can actually view it. So there's kind of there's an extra cost in there.
Right. And if you're donating it, presumably you want people to use it. So
yeah.
What's been sort of the challenge as an editor, sort of even beyond like the topics themselves?
Well, since I was just editing things on the train on the way to New York, I made an effort when I was taking the case studies to try to include, some people who maybe hadn't published before or whose names were not as familiar as some of the other names that people will see. Because, you know, they've had their really interesting experiences. And it was, some people are just better writers than other people. And that's a fact of life. And some people have done wonderful work, but they don't know how to talk about it. And it's, and that's okay. You know, I've gone through more drafts with some people than with others. But everybody who I've worked with on this has been really great about taking that feedback and making the changes and getting things in a timely fashion. So But yeah, working with, because usually I'm in the past books that I've done, I've been editing things by people who I knew fairly well, and I knew the product that I was going to get. But some people have just needed more assistance. And I hope to God that when you look at the book, you will not have any idea which case studies were the ones that I had to help more than others. They should all be at the same level of excellence. As I said, just trying to get the balance and trying to, you know, always feeling like I'm missing, there must be some project out there that I'm missing. And at a certain point, I'm like, honey, we just got to go with what we got. We got to put the book together. Yeah.
So how are you feeling about the state of innovation in archives after getting all these submissions? And
I'm feeling pretty good. I think that I don't want to say I'm feeling terrible. That's not a very good marketing tip, but that's actually true.
Yeah, my question is actually, how good are you feeling?
How good am I feeling? I'm feeling great. I'm feeling good. I think that what I'm seeing across the what I think all of these demonstrate is a desire. You know, people are, not surprisingly, they're being very flexible and creative in working within what they've got, which is what most of what, which is critical for any archival organizations. You got to work with what you got. In most cases, most of them are about, you know, most of them are not about grant funded projects. In fact, one of them is specifically a digital humanities one is specifically about, and she talks about how they applied for funding and they got turned down, and they applied for funding and they got turned down. And then they just, you know, figured out a way to do it. And that's what a lot of them are about, just figuring out, you know, let's just get this done. I think the phrase on a shoestring only appears in one title, but it could appear in more than one title. And again, for me, it's like I want to put out examples of things people could really do. Yeah. Or, you know, think that they have a shot at doing that. They can see how that could be something that would work for them.
So mentioning the digital humanities, I guess sort of how much interdisciplinary work did you see in some of these use cases? And was that a function of sort of budgetary limitations or expanded sort of use and breadth of collections?
If you could see this, listeners, you'd see me puzzle. I have a puzzled expression. I'm interdisciplinary. Not in management, because that doesn't really apply as much. Outreach, I wouldn't call it interdisciplinary. And reference and access is where the access portion of reference and access. Yeah. There's one on a digital humanities project. And in some of the access ones, you can see a little bit more of interaction with the scholarly community coming in, and with description also. But I would think for the instruction book, that would be one where we'd see a little bit more of that. I had a hell of a time getting a digital humanities one. That was hard.
So you solicited it?
It was hard because, if you follow me on Twitter, you may have seen me doing this. What I wanted to get was a digital humanities project in which the Archives or Special Collections was a true collaborator and not just a resource. And people got back to me, and then when I followed up with them, they were like, yeah, we're not really a true collaborator. I thought I wasn't going to be able to include one, and I really wanted to, and then I don't even remember. I think actually somebody came up to me and said, I hear you're looking, and, you know, I think we might have something for you here.
Right.
But it was hard, and it was sort of depressing because I kept asking. It's like, I want true collaboration, and it was just not happening. In the projects that I was talking to, I'm sure it's happening somewhere, but it wasn't happening in any of the projects that I was finding.
Yeah. What about any audio or moving image materials?
Moving image.
Shut out again.
No moving image. Hey, listen, I put in an open call, man.
But was that open call on film?
Or I should have done video? An audio open call. I don't think so. This is terrible. I should like know all of these off the top of my head. Josh,
did you submit anything? I guess that's the question.
But appraisal and acquisition. He'll give a plug for the next book, for which the call will probably be in about January or February of 2014. Issues with appraisal and acquisition of audiovisual materials would be sort of interesting.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm on it.
I'm staring.
I think I was in Trenton the entire time when those calls were coming out on a rather large project.
Okay, it's okay.
Trenton makes, the world takes, man.
It's true. they took a piece of me.
So
buy the books, please.
Yeah, no, they sound great.
They're going to be good, and I believe they're supposed to be reasonably priced, although I don't control that if that actually doesn't happen to be the case. I believe they are supposed to be reasonably priced. So
the practical orientation sounds good.
That's what I'm shooting for. Yeah. So we'll see how I succeed.
Yeah, exciting.
So Scarecrow Press.
Scarecrow.
Mm-hmm. What's the title of the series?
Yeah, is there a series title?
Yeah.
It's Innovative Practices in Archives and Special Collections, and then each one will, you know, in management description, blah, 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 blah.
Okay. Pre-order on Amazon.
Believe me, when you can order them, I will be letting people know. And it's also because the people who've... obviously I worked hard on this, but I'm really excited about giving these people who are writing the case studies the opportunity to get their work out in front of people, because a lot of them are at places that, you know, probably don't get out in front of in people's attention very often. So it'll be fun. I've got one from the National Archives of Iceland. Yeah.
Interesting.
And I had to admit, I really don't know that much about the National Archives of Iceland. So there you go. Buy the book.
No problems with temperature control there.
No, that's, yeah.
So it's an international, I guess the case studies are international.
Oh, yeah.
I sort of assumed that they were mostly.
Scotland, Wales, Australia, Iceland, Canada. That might be, I believe those are all the countries that are represented.
And I guess what's the sort of level of governmental and academic and sort of historical society, cultural heritage?
I strove, is that what I'm trying to say? I tried to achieve a balance. It's, as with many things, you're going to see a lot of college and university. But I tried to get government, and I went after business archives, but not very much success in getting them to talk about that. But it's government, and I went after some state governments to try to get, and it's harder to get them to.
Yeah.
So, yeah. They're mostly bigger organizations, except for the place in Wales, I think is, well, it sounds relatively, I don't want to insult the people in Wales, but it sounds like a fairly small organization to me. They're the ones doing web chat for reference, which is sort of interesting because they've got, you know, of course, people all over the world are interested in their family history. So their audience is bigger than just their geographic region.
Cool.
Yeah. Should we talk about SAA?
Sure. SAA was recently. We're recording this a month or two after, I guess. How was your time in New Orleans?
My time in New Orleans was probably not as much fun as what I hear a lot of other people had. But since I was still serving on SAA Council, one's time is usually spoken for quite a bit.
I saw all those Twitter pics of the drinks.
That was when those were when it was over. Yes.
There was a whole table of drinks.
There
apparently.
Was a whole table of drinks. That was, and it was, for those of you who aren't on Twitter. So my term as on SAA Council was up at the end of the business meeting on Saturday, which is the last thing. And so, as you might expect, some friends and I went out and we had a few cocktails.
Yeah.
And there were pictures of all the cocktails that everybody was having, not just me. on the table, and it was sort of not fair because my friends who were still on SAA Council were seeing the pictures of the cocktails while they were in a meeting. I thought it was a pretty good meeting. I thought the quality of the sessions was really good this year.
Yeah.
It always depends on which ones you end up in, so, you know, it's kind of random. But I thought it was successful.
Yeah. So how was your time on council, or what are you proudest of accomplishing, or looking back on it now, I'm not sure whether we congratulate you for having served, or give our condolences.
You congratulate me for having served.
Yes. We thank you too, of course.
We thank you for your service. I encourage, because I've been on the nominating committee and I had to approach people about running. And it's one of those things where if you have an opportunity to do it, you should always do it. But when I was being approached to run, I swear to God, I think somebody told me that it was fun. Look, it's not fun. It's rewarding, and you can have fun moments, and I'm friends with people I didn't used to be friends with, and it's great, but it's not fun. At least, maybe they have a very different idea of fun than I do. It's a rewarding experience. When at the business meeting, when Jackie Dooley was, they're doing the whole goodbye to all the people, and I'm last in the alphabet, right? Were you there? So Jackie's, I'm last in the alphabet of the three people, and so she had sort of a one-word description for each person who was going off council. And I'm sitting there going, oh, man, what one word is she going to come up with for me? And I think I can't remember if it was instigator. It was something like instigator.
That's a good word to have, yeah.
Yeah, it was. I can't remember. Like Donna McRae was like, the wise person. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's not going to be me. And I remember Dennis Meisner was something very, appropriate for Dennis Meisner. And that's why I'm sitting there going, oh, man. I think it was instigator. And I certainly did initiate. Not to instigate. There were a number of things that I'm proud of getting moving, like the annual meeting task force and just pushing things along that I think needed to happen. And the timing is also it's also interesting for those of you who don't know. Every year the SAA Council is different because three people rotate on and three people rotate off and you've got a new president. So the sort of the little microclimate is different every year. And I should say that every year that I was on, it got, from my perspective, better for what I wanted to do and how I like to work. And the people who are on now, that's quite a crew there.
Instigators involved?
There are some instigators there, which, warms my heart. And of course, Terry Baxter is on. Terry's a presence.
What word would you use to describe once Terry rotates off?
Terry.
You don't have to answer that.
I think you just say Terry, and that's all you need to do.
Hugs.
But yeah, I'm glad I was on for the drafting of their new five-year strategic plan.
Yeah.
And we were joking around this before we started taping about strategic planning and how most people don't really like it, but it is an important thing to do. And also being able to sort of try to get in some things that I wanted to see happen.
What'd you get in there?
You can blame me for.
You can also just, what you think the plan will accomplish overall or what areas you think it addresses if you don't want to take attribution for specific points. Or if you think they'll be successful, you should take attribution for them now so that you can get credit when they work out.
I'll take credit for, because I think if I was not the only person, I was at least part of the little cluster of people who came up with this one. And I don't remember it verbatim. If you're looking at the plan and you're saying, what the hell is that? And that makes no sense, then you can blame me. I will take that. I don't remember how it was expressed. And I think it's still in there. I don't think it could cut. About trying to mess, it's sort of an organizational culture one, to make the organization, more nimble or flexible or willing to take chances. I don't remember how the words actually came out in the end. Nimble was a word that got kicked around. I thought it was important to have that in there, even though once you try to come up with stuff that goes underneath it, the tasks and the measurables, I don't know. So that might have actually gotten bumped up to being a value. Because I don't really remember how to. But what was important to me about that is I think that there has been a perception and a reality, quite frankly, that SAA is not as good at adapting and responding. And some of that I do think was due to being risk averse, which isn't all that uncommon in organizations. So it's not. Or with archivists either. But I do think that in the current environment that we all live in, people are much more tolerant. We'll see how tolerant SAA members are if things get too crazy. But things like making changes to Archival Outlook, which is the newsletter, I have views about that, which I've expressed about what I think should happen with that. But that's a membership benefit, and the fact that I think that my personal view is that I don't need to have a paper newsletter coming to me. It's not how I like to receive information. But there are people who do like to receive information that way, and so how. It's a balance between making changes to move in one direction, but wanting to make sure that the members who still like that are not too unhappy if things change.
Right. And the annual meeting task force, do you want to talk about that?
Sure. It's wrapped up its work very successfully, I thought. And that was like a crazy, 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 crazy ambitious thing. That because they were looking at basically every aspect of the meeting across a lot of different dimensions, and they didn't have, they had some time, but it was there are a lot of moving parts, because whenever you talk about, basically everything gets back to money pretty much, but I think that they did a really good job. I'm very happy with the council approved. I don't remember how it was expressed, but basically some values, some sort of, philosophical statements about how the annual meeting is supposed to work. And if you look at those, they say things like, we are open to innovation, nothing is set in stone, we have to adhere to tradition, which when I was doing things with SAA, quite a while back, but not that long ago, there certainly was a feeling, particularly around some things with the annual meeting, that there were things that were kind of set in stone, and that's the way we do things. And I'm really happy that that is no longer the governing principle. So that's sort of, we're dedicated to exploration and also moving the meeting around the country and trying different venues and going to different places. Because there were certainly a lot of people who were frustrated with the limitation on the places that the meeting could go.
Right. I'd like you to talk to some professional organizations that I belong to. Because there are those similar problems where there are things, they're more like traditions. They're like, it's not a set in stone thing, but it's like, we always do this every year. And because of that, there are limitations to the places where the event can take place. Yeah. And it's basically gotten down to just a handful of cities where these events can take place, and it's become a real flashpoint within the organization. People want to go to different places, but they don't understand the problem there.
And that's what, and this is actually documented in many conversations on the Archives Next blog, about people being frustrated with why can't we go to smaller places? Why can't we do this? And the city, the locations, and that's it. Well, we can't do this because of this, and we can't do this because of this. And that's why the group was set up so that everything, so that the way I tried to set it up was that you could not use anything as an excuse to say, well, we can't talk about that. So I wanted everything to be within the purview of the group, so they would actually be able to achieve the kind of a change that they have achieved. NSA is going to Cleveland, which would not have been probably on our radar as a so-called second-tier city.
Oh, don't say so-called that. Cleveland.
Second-tier.
Poor Cleveland.
I know. It's not a good term. I don't know. I mean, I believe it's, anyway, there's some sort of reason you use it, but smaller cities.
Yeah. It's not, though, but when you think about it, like, those cities, that's where history happened. in America. And, you know, if you want to see stuff, if you want to have events around historical stuff or the growth of things and to see stuff, then you have to hit those places like Cleveland that may not be what they once were, but...
There was something that's going to be coming up on the council agenda. Is there were sort of a list of criteria on which the council, you know, agreed they were going to make their decisions. And one of the ones that had been on the list, and I can't remember what it is, but, you know, sort of like cultural attractions and historical importance or something. And every city has every city has something of interest. Now, you know, it might not have a lot, depending on how big it is, but there's something interesting of cultural interest, historical interest in every city. So it's really just up to people and the host committee to make sure everybody knows about it. But yeah, that seemed like sort of a, you know, odd, almost elitist thing. Although it might have been put in so that we don't have to go back to Disney World again. That was before my time, but apparently SAA went to Orlando to Disney World and... Mm-hmm. That was not a popular decision. So that might have been put in specifically.
Yeah, I wouldn't go to Disney World.
Yeah.
See, I would, but, you know.
Yeah, well, what other sort of SAA trend-related things?
It's...
have you seen ongoing?
Another thing that's coming out, SAA does have a tendency, whenever they want to make a change, to put together a task force or a working group. That's how they do it. So every time...
Not unique to them.
I know. So every time you want to do it, it's like, let's make a working group. So the one on member affinity groups, which is a way of talking about sections and roundtables and other things like that... I think that could be a really interesting one, too, because that's another area in which, to a certain extent, some are very active and some are not. And
there's a lot of confusion about what the difference even is between them.
Yes.
And maybe that's just for the uninformed of us.
No, that's not.
So there are certain privileges afforded to some. You're only allowed membership in some of these, but unlimited membership in roundtables.
Yeah, and there are a lot of questions about... whether any of that makes sense
right.
Now, as opposed to, you know, whether it made sense at one point. I'm sure it did to somebody, or else we wouldn't have it that way. But I'm really interested to see what that group is going to do, because especially with what technology allows us to do now, if the point of those organ groups are to have members have a way to get together and communicate, there are lots of ways people can get together and communicate. So what's really... the point or the function that different ones are serving, and what do members really want them to do? And should we have a million, or should we have a lot, very few? Anyway, so it's, I'm going to be curious to see that. And that's another area in which, you know, we could see some really interesting recommendations come out that could prove this whole nimble, flexible, whatever, risk-oriented culture.
And how do I get some input there so that they consider a moving image section or roundtable, whichever? Because there isn't a specific one for it. There's visual materials, which it's pretty much dominated by photography, and that doesn't really incorporate video.
But the process of starting a round table is relatively easy.
Well, that's the funny part. It's starting a round table is like dead easy.
Right.
I mean, it takes nothing to start a round table, which is why we have more of them now than we used to. And so that was sort of a discussion. I'm like, well, there was a discussion about, is it a problem that we have all these round tables? Is it a problem that we have, or is it good that we have all these round tables? There's a certain resource issue.
Yeah.
There's a sort of administrative cost. So, but then on the other hand, if the members want to have all these roundtables because it allows them to communicate and network and share information, that's kind of what the whole thing is about. So,
yeah, but I also see it because there's also the concern about how long the conference is. And when you're trying to cram in all of those section and roundtable meetings.
Right, there's a
whole
day.
They start conflicting.
And there are ideas about how to schedule that so that they get more integrated in, you know, like with having section and roundtable meetings actually sort of, you know, on the integrated into the rest of the schedule.
B sessions.
Yeah. Well, or at least be in a session time slot.
Right.
So, or whether groups to a certain extent really need to do do they need to meet face to face? Maybe they do, maybe they don't. That's something that the group, I think, is supposed to be looking at, is what is the function of the time at the annual meeting? How do people really want to spend that time at the annual meeting? I mean, if you have a certain time block, what's really valuable? I think there are some interesting things that are possible. And as with everything, if SAA has the technology infrastructure to support that, then there's a lot of things that can be done. So,
yeah, I was at the web archiving one this year, which was its first meeting, and it just started, and it was really successful. A lot of people, good program. On the flip side of that, I have no idea what my membership is in roundtables. I could very well be a member of like 8 of them. Some of them are just an email every once in a while.
Every once in a while, and they don't necessarily do a lot. I'll be curious to see how that conversation evolves. And I'm really glad that at least that's something that is being talked about. So that's that. There's. It seems like there is over the past, I guess, 3 or 4 years, much more of a willingness to look at things than I had the impression there was before. I had the impression
good qualifier.
That was not something that we did. So I'm happy with that apparent organizational culture shift.
Yeah, that's good.
So where do you see SAA going? Are you optimistic about the future? as optimistic as you are about the innovation and.
I'm optimistic about the future. I hope there are lots of things that I hope they're able to do, and certainly the membership numbers continue to go up. I think we saw a slight decline, at least in the rate of increase. A sizable percentage of that membership are students. If you pay attention to the membership numbers, it's a pretty substantial portion are either students or in the lowest income category, because SAA membership is by income category. That's interesting, and there certainly could be
poses some challenges.
Yes. It's not a bad thing that there are lots of young people. I mean, it's not a bad thing to have young, presumably younger, but, newer to the profession people engaged in the society to the extent that they are engaged. I don't know. For some student members, I don't know how really engaged they feel in the organization, and that's okay.
There's a good point there. I mean, what is the engagement? But beyond, if you're not going to the annual meeting, I think that is sometimes maybe difficult for.
With students,
or complicated. I mean,
you get the book discount, which I think is for some people. Certainly, for some people, the reason they join is students, because you get the discount on the books, and there's nothing wrong with that. I'm sure I did it too.
Will they get discounts on your books? We're just kidding.
No, I believe that Scarecrow will be offering. I think they will be offered to the SAA bookstore, so you will get.
Note to students.
I believe. And so that's interest. It's interesting, and I don't know what will happen to those students as they leave and attempt to get jobs, because there's certainly a lot of students in the pipeline right now. I'll be interested to see how the membership numbers, what happens to that.
Yeah.
But I'm optimistic. I think there's energy. I think there's a level of energy in the profession, which if SAA is able to harness or continue to harness, could be very positive. But I hope that people who sometimes get frustrated with a professional organization, which it's easy to do, channel that back into trying to make it a better organization instead of walking away. And it's easy to think about walking away, but that doesn't really help. I think the archival profession has an opportunity to really promote itself and prove its value. But as we all know from our individual, it's the same thing at the individual level it is as it is at the professional level. It's always about needing to talk to people about what you do and why it's important. And that kind of elevator speech is the kind of thing that SA as an organization has to keep doing.
Yeah.
I'll just go back in the archive.
Go offline, it's, off yeah. the grid.
Well, it's not, you know, it's not for everybody. It's really great that there are people who are willing to serve in their professional organizations, and God bless them. The people who are serving on steering groups of three different sections or whatever.
Yeah, I think students these days are very keen to the value, professional and personal, of taking part in the SAA or MARAC or any archives-related professional organization. Seems like something that wasn't necessarily enforced, not enforced, but advocated for or taught in school 10 years ago.
It's very much a part of your program. When I was at the University of Michigan, we were sort of, you know, we were encouraged. It was, you know, obviously not required, but it was sort of, you know, yeah, this is what you do. You should join SAA, da-da-da-da. That's what you should do. And we did. And but one thing that that my husband, who's the treasurer of MARAC, so I have no formal position with MARAC, the Mid-Atlantic Regional Archives Caucus Conference,
Conference. Yeah.
Shoot. But he pays a lot. He has a lot of access to the information, and he says the number of students who've been coming to MARAC meetings has really been increasing and pretty steady. And he says that's a change that did not used to be the case. So it's great. And I think that regional organizations and metropolitan organizations are a great way for students and newer archivists to do the kind of networking which is, as we know, so critical.
Right. Yeah, there's talk even of trying to get SAA to do more regional-oriented events.
Yeah, that was something that they did talk about, yeah. Either, you know, partnering or doing them. But yeah, so that's, you know, and again, that's why I feel optimistic, is because I think there's a level of energy that makes me feel optimistic.
Yeah, great.
Well, that sounds like a happy note to end on.
That's a good note.
We should probably go on, because we don't want to end on a happy note.
Well, we have the chance to talk archives much later this evening, so yes.
As we do every evening.
Right.
It's our lives.
There's always a chance to talk about it.
Yeah, we can't drink at this one. We can drink after this one. But, yes. I guess we're wrapping it up because we're about at our hour.
Yeah.
So, Kate, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.